you know that this is a joint production publication by IOM and MPI, which we started earlier this year, to focus on important migration development issues in the region. And I hope that it is contributing to some important policy discourse in the region, as we have to evident today. We hope that these issues in brief will actually bring focus on some of these important issues, raise awareness, better understanding, but very importantly actually start or stimulate some sort of policy discussion. Today's issue is on an extremely important and topical issue, and this is on regulating private recruitment in the Asia-Middle East labor migration corridor. And I believe the issues raised in the paper is also very relevant and pertinent to other major labor migration corridors. We have the distinguished ambassador from Mexico here, and I believe that he can also reflect on the situation that pertains to his region in terms of labor migration. The paper has been authored by none other than Ms. Davlin Agunias, who is the regional research officer for IOM and the policy analyst for MPI. In fact, issues in brief is the brainchild of Davlin, and she is the managing editor of the issues in brief, and we are extremely happy that actually she is presenting her own paper at this session today. It is heavily drawn from her own research in the area, which is covered in the region, and I will not even attempt or dare to go into what's covered in the paper. I leave that for Davlin to cover, and we can take it up later on in our discussions. We are also extremely pleased to have here with us this morning two very distinguished panelists, Dr. Supang Chantanavich. She's a professor at the Chulalongkorn University and the director of the Asian Research Center for Migration. She has done extensive research in the areas of migration, transnationalism, refugees, migration policy, and human trafficking, with a special focus on Southeast Asia. She has, I believe, written a recent paper on Thailand's recruitment industry, madam, right? She will be commenting on the paper, and we hope that we can hear a little bit more about the situation that also persists not only between the Asia migration corridor, but also the migration that is taking place within the region. Thailand itself is a very important destination country, in addition to being an important sending country. She has to her credit numerous accolades and awards. I will not even go into that. She is also a member of the subcommittee on the standard of migrant worker employment in the Ministry of Labour in Thailand. She has actually won numerous prestigious awards, including the most outstanding research award at the Chulalongkorn University. And in 2005, she was honored with the prize of most outstanding researcher in sociology from the National Research Council in Thailand. So we're extremely happy that, madam, you can join us this morning. We are also very pleased to have Ms. Jaewon Kim. As you have seen from the paper, the recruitment industry, the sector labor migration on the one hand has the labor, migrant labor, and the other hand, the business. The recruiting agencies, the business which employs the migrant workers. It is very important that we hope we can have an opportunity to hear more from Ms. Kim about the business. She's the manager of the business for social responsibility, and that's very important. If we can hear more about what is the social responsibility that the business have in terms of migrant workers and migrant labor. Ms. Kim is based in Hong Kong, and she is the manager for the Business for Social Responsibility. She works on projects in BSR's growing Asia presence, focusing particularly on advisory service and project management in Korea and Japan. And I'm also very pleased to see that she worked for IOM in Seoul at some point of time, leading various projects and advising the government on immigration and labor issues. So we have the perfect combination of two panelists here. And I'm also very pleased to see that she has also established government and civil society network relations. We have a few civil society representatives here. I'm very happy to see that. So yes, we have a very good panel up here. My job becomes easier. So without further ado, I would like to now call upon Davlin to present her paper. Dublin. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Rabab. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming here and for having your breakfast with us very early in the morning. I hope you had a good one. I'd always like to start my talk by stating something which is so obvious. Everybody would say, what is she talking about? So let me start with something that is very obvious. And that is the fact that private recruitment agencies are very important actors. They account for a vast majority of contract labor migration from the region. They assume a wide range of functions that goes beyond recruitment, from promoting manpower to matching to even, as we've seen in the case of Libya, repatriating distressed workers. In short, without private agencies, temporary labor migration, as we know today, would not have been possible. And that is very true for the Asia-Middle East labor migration corridor. Now, the question at hand for us here and for many others who are thinking about recruitment is, how do you manage recruitment agencies? How do you manage their operations more effectively? Because if you leave them unregulated or you leave them poorly regulated, these agencies would abuse the workers that they're supposed to help. The issue in brief that we are launching today and that we're talking about today touch on this very core issue of regulation. And I'm here to set the discussion by laying out some of the key points that were highlighted in the brief. What I'm about to share to you, as Rabab mentioned, is informed largely by my own field work. Since 2009, I've been working on this issue, and I've actually spent some time on the ground interviewing recruitment agencies, talking to migrant workers, employers, businesses, members of the civil society, international organizations, government officials, embassy officials, primarily in four countries: Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Jordan, and the United Arab Emirates, UAE. And so much of what I will say is informed by my interactions with many of these different actors in the recruitment industry. So I'll start my talk by discussing to you three characteristics that I think characterize Asian labor migration to the Middle East, and then I'll discuss some of the key recruitment-related issues that are affecting this corridor, and then I'll end with some policy options. I think that there are three distinct features that characterize Asian labor migration to the Middle East, which explains for the most part how and why is it very difficult to control this labor migration corridor. First, the Middle East region is distinguished by this unparalleled dependence on temporary labor migrant workers, unparalleled elsewhere in the world. Over half of the population of the Arab Gulf right now are migrant workers. Many of them are from this region. They dominate up to 80% of private employment in some of the smaller and richer countries in the Middle East. If you compare that to, let's say, one of what we'd imagine as destination of migrants like the United States or Australia or Canada, the population of migrants in these countries are much less. In the United States, 14% of the population are migrants. In Australia, 20% of the population are migrants. So the dependence on migrant workers is unparalleled elsewhere in the Middle East. And despite these overwhelming numbers in the region, many Asian migrant workers in the region remain vulnerable, and they face significant rights risks and abuses. And this vulnerability stems from the fact of the nature of their work, of the type of work they do, of the skills that they have, of the sectors that they work in. Our IOM office in Cairo conducted this regional study about 2 years ago, and they found that over half of migrant workers in the Gulf are illiterate or can just barely read or write. Another quarter have low levels of education. Women constitute a significant proportion of the labor force in a number of countries. For instance, they comprise a third of the labor force in Oman, a fifth of the labor force in Bahrain and Kuwait. Domestic workers, a lot of Asian migrants in the region are domestic workers. And I would argue it's one, and I believe you would agree with me, one of the most unprotected sectors in the region. And the third characteristic is the fact that the Middle East, despite all of this, remains one of the most sought after, one of the most competitive labor markets in the world. People wanted to work there. Many migrant workers are fully aware of the risks involved working in the Middle East. They're willing to pay a steep premium to work in the Middle East. sizable sums of money, and in a number of cases, a lot of cases, accept less than ideal work conditions. In short, they want to be there, they want to work there, and you wonder why. Well, it's because of the fact that there are extremely limited opportunities to work elsewhere, especially for the low-skilled workers. The United States, Canada, Australia, most of Europe are closed to temporary workers, especially low-skilled. And so if I am a low-skilled worker from the Philippines, my only chances of leaving and working abroad is to the Middle East. Even for highly skilled workers, let's say if I'm a nurse from the Philippines, I would actually spend less money working in the Middle East than it's, say, eyeing to get a job in Canada. That's why it's competitive. That's why people wanted to be there. And the problems related in the recruitment of workers in this corridor are many, but I think the fees are at the center of the most recruitment irregularities. Recruiters are charging excessive prices. They're collecting fees too early. They're failing to issue receipts. There have been many studies, some from the ILO, some from the IOM, some from private organizations. We did a study at MPI as well. And these studies found that about roughly two-thirds of the cost of recruitment to the migrants are actually charges by the recruitment agents or the middlemen and the sub-agents. So it's a big part of the cost to migrants, the cost of recruitment. And what I found interesting in my own field work is that how much of this fee is dictated by demand. So for instance, if you are a female factory worker in Sri Lanka and you wanted to work in Jordan, you pay between $150 to $250, which is about a month's salary. But if you're a male worker in Sri Lanka and you wanted to work in a factory in Jordan, you pay $500 to $700 in placement fee, which is 2 to 3 times the monthly salary, which is 2 to 3 times more than what your female counterparts would pay. And I will explain to you later why. But clearly the fees important issue to be addressed. To pay recruitment fees and processing fees, migrants take large loans, requiring repayment at extremely high interest rates. So what they do is they agree to a salary deduction scheme in which they take the employer take 3 to 5 months worth of their salary as payment. There are also legal but not expected deductions that the agents didn't really tell them that will be deducted from their income, such as the price of the air ticket or the accommodation. And migrants came into the region, they're already there, they're starting their work, and they look at their payslip and realize, how come I'm paying less than what I was promised? And then the employer will explain to them, well, because we're deducting the airfare, or we're deducting accommodation, or we're deducting food. And at that moment in time, there's no more turning back. Migrants also face new contracts, you know, that they sign on arrival that is different from the contracts that they sign in the destination. And these contracts have lower stipulations, such as the lower salary or different conditions, practice called contract substitution. One interesting thing that I found in my own field work is that cases where migrants, for some reason or another, are already in the region, and then they decided, I cannot continue my contract. I want to go home. And in these cases, the recruitment agency or the employer would ask the migrant to pay the deployment cost of sending them there. In other words, you want to go home? Pay me back the $3,000 I spent to get you here. And I've talked to government officials, recruiters, migrant workers, and everyone agrees that many could not afford to pay the deployment costs, and which amounted to a year's salary in the case of domestic workers, for instance. So they were essentially forced to resume work and finish their contract. And this practice of demanding repayment of the deployment cost make migrants really extremely vulnerable, because unlike placement fees, the fee that you pay before you leave the country, deployment costs are not regulated by the government. And so the employer and the recruitment agent can just ask how much money they wanted to ask. I think the more important question, and we all know this what I've just said, the more important question is what can be done at the policy level. And in the brief highlighted 4 key broad areas where governments could start thinking about in terms of regulating this industry. I think that number one of the key goals should be to reduce the number of agencies in the first place. I think the part of the problem is that there's just too many of them. And certainly in the case that I'm very familiar with, which is the Philippines and Sri Lanka and Jordan and the UAE, you might think, well, isn't that the point? Isn't that the point that you wanted to have more agencies so that there'll be more competition, so that if you have more competition, then migrants have more choices and migrants are better protected? But I think in the case of the recruitment agency, the converse is true. In fact, competition, too much competition, cutthroat competition, drive inefficient agencies out, does not drive inefficient agencies out of the system. In other words, if you are losing money because you're inefficient, you will not close your shop. And what we've seen in the Philippines in particular is that many of these unprofitable recruitment agencies actually make money by cutting even more corners and by breaking more rules. And that's by charging more fees to the recruitment, to the migrant workers who wanted to leave the country regardless, and by colluding as well with employers. And then they could do that because the rules and the regulations are difficult to enforce in the first place. So it is important. The number one step is to decongest the market. And you can do that not just by requiring agencies to go through stringent requirements. Governments do that a lot. So for instance, if you're a recruitment agency, you wanted to show that you have money, you wanted to show that you could post bonds, you wanted to show that you don't have any criminal records, stuff like that. But I think what is also equally important is by rewarding agencies that meet and exceed government standards by coming up with a rating or labeling systems. And that has been, I think that will be tried in Jordan in not so distant future, so that agencies that are actually good get rewarded financially as well. The second option, I think, second policy route is really to think about the sub-agent's role in this industry and how to bring the sub-agents to the formal sector. Private agencies, recruitment agencies that are licensed, do not work alone. Many of these recruitment agencies are in the city centers, and they work with informal brokers who find prospective migrants and also work with employers, and they're the ones who connect the migrant worker to the recruitment agent. So in other words, you have the employer, you have the recruitment agent, you have the sub-agent, and then you have the migrants. So the sub-agent is another layer of recruitment, and it's another layer of cost. And the problem is, how do you actually put them into the formal sector? In Sri Lanka, a year and a half ago, they were thinking of registering this sub-agent so that they could actually be part of the system somewhere or another. Because what's concerning about this sub-agent is that they're independent. They're not accountable to the employers or the agents that they work with. They're not formally associated with them. And they're not accountable to the migrants that they help deploy. So it's very hard to control them, and that's where a lot of the problems arises from. The third policy area, I think, that's not being really thought about is regulating the transactions between the agencies and between the agencies and the employer. If you think about regulations that came out about how to regulate recruitment agents, most of the regulations focus on framing the migrant's relationship with the recruitment agent or with the employer. So for instance, almost all governments, a lot of governments right now, have regulations that say how much placement fee you can charge to a migrant worker. In the Philippines, if you are a domestic worker, a recruitment agent cannot charge you a placement fee. If you are a nurse, an agent can charge you up to a month's salary. And a number of governments in the region have regulations to that. But I think one area that has not been really thought about are regulations that concerns the transactions between the recruitment agency at the destination and the recruitment agency at the origin. I think it's really an important point to think about is that how migrants fare in the recruitment marketplace is determined by how the recruitment agencies connect to each other. So let me give you an example to illustrate this point. In Jordan, if you are a recruitment agent in Jordan and you wanted to get a Filipina domestic worker, you ask the employer, the household, for about 2,800 JD, which is about 2,000 JD, which is about $2,800. So I am a Jordanian family. I wanted a Filipina maid. I pay the Jordanian agent 2,000 JD or $2,800. The Jordanian agent will then contact the Filipino agent and say, okay, I'll get the $1,000 from that. I'll give you the $2,000. You find me a domestic worker. So every recruitment agent in the Philippines gets $2,000 for every domestic worker that he or she deploys. If you talk to the, and the recruitment agent in the Philippines would use the $2,000 to purchase airfare, pay sub-agents, cover other costs such as bribes, you know, you name it. And if you talk to the agents in Jordan, they would tell you, oh, Devlin, these recruitment agents in the Philippines are so bad. They are asking for stiff commissions. They are increasing their fees with no clear reason. It's increasing the cost of my business. And you wonder, okay, but the Jordanian agent wanted to make money, and so the Jordanian agent will, guess what, extract the losses that he or she getting from the recruitment agent from the Philippines to the migrant worker themselves. The weakest chain in the link is the migrant worker, and that weakest chain bears the cost. Agents also collude with employers at the destination that will drive the cost of recruitment. So, for instance, you wonder how come males pay more for recruitment fees than females if you're working in a factory. If you go to Sri Lanka, they tell you, well, if I'm an agent, Sri Lankan agent, and I wanted to send a migrant worker to, let's say, the UAE, the UAE factory will say, I wanted a female worker. And why? Well, because female workers, unlike male, they don't consume alcohol, and males engage in fights. And they engage in fights with other nationalities. So I want female workers. And so if I send a female worker, the employer in the Middle East would give me $200 for every female worker I send. Now, male workers are not in demand. And so what will happen is that if you wanted to send male workers, you actually bribe the employer and say, I'll give you $350 to $400. And that's in the case of Sri Lanka, $400 to get a male worker. And so the employer and or the broker for that employer would say, sure, we'll get the male worker. And the Sri Lankan agent would then go back to the male worker and say, you have to pay up. And that is the reason why male workers are paying three times more than the female workers for the same job, for the same destination. And because the marketplace is crowded, everyone is a piece of that market, migrants will pay, and they will pay as much as they can. And the fourth policy area that I think is really important, and this is very obvious, but it's, I think, worth putting in there, is the regulations governing recruitment agencies must be harmonized at the origin and destination. There are so many regulations at the origin side, there's so many regulations at the destination side, but they don't match. And this mismatch between the origin and the destination countries on these key areas is what is creating all these loopholes that allow unscrupulous actors to game the system. Let me give you an example of how this works. In 2008, and let's go back to Jordan and the Philippines, because I've already given examples on it, so you could follow the money trail here. In 2008, the Philippine government banned its local recruitment agencies from recruiting workers, domestic workers to Jordan. There were problems of underpayment of wages, non-payment of wages, exploitative working conditions. So the Philippine government said, we're not sending domestic workers to Jordan. If you are a recruitment agency in the Philippines and you send workers to Jordan, your license get canceled. And Jordanian agencies cannot go to the Philippines to directly recruit workers. So what is interesting is that the ban was imposed in 2008, but between 2008 and 2010, government officials, embassy officials in Amman of the in the Philippines said that they estimate that 10,000 migrant workers went to Jordan to work as domestic workers. 10,000 migrant workers defied the ban. And you wonder why? Well, there are recruitment agencies in Jordan, they're licensed, they're legal agencies, and they still recruit Filipino workers in the Philippines, but they do now with illegal recruiters in the Philippines. The migrants leave the Philippines as tourists, but then they go, when they reach Jordan, they have legal papers. They have valid entry permits. They have working permits. So from the perspective of Jordan, these are legal workers. From the perspective of the Philippines, these workers left without our authorization. And in the Philippine law, if you're working, if you're leaving to work, you need to have papers from the Philippine government attesting that you are actually eligible to work. And so the difference now is that the ban is there, but it's not being recognized by the Jordanian government. And the recruitment agents among themselves figure out how the way to game the system. And the recruitment agent in the Philippines need to come up with a way to circumvent the border controls that the Philippine government imposed to make sure that no tourist pretending to be tourists will leave the country. And circumventing border controls is easy if you have $2,000 for domestic workers to spend. The ban was imposed unilaterally by the Philippine government. It did not stop workers from going. And it's because of the fact that there's a strong demand for Filipina domestic workers. They speak English. They love them. They wanted them. The Philippine ambassador to Jordan, in an interview, framed the situation in a very, very good way that made me understand what it's really about. He's saying that the government, by imposing the ban, closed the door, but the windows are quite open. And there's this wide open window to Jordan, and a lot of Filipinas took that window. And we know what happens when you take the window, jump out of the window, as opposed to walking out the door. I would walk out the door 10 times out of 10, then jump out of the window. And that is the danger of instituting policies that look good in paper, that satisfy some demands, but does not translate well on the ground, because it ignores the forces of supply and demand. Let me end by saying something that's another quite obvious statement. And you all know this. And that is that recruitment is a big business. It's a big business. And big businesses usually attract really smart people, creative people, innovative people. And unscrupulous agencies are unfortunately one step ahead of government. You come up with a rule and they will know how to go around it. And it's important to plug these holes. And one way to do that is to ensure that governments at both sides actually come up with a coordinated response. Otherwise, we're just going to go and run in circles. And no one government should bear the burden of regulating recruitment, because if you think about it, international migration is transcending borders. It's by definition transcending borders. And the problems that arise from this international movement of people are transnational, and the solutions must be transnational. I don't know how we're going to get there, but we need to at some point in time. Thank you.
Thank you, Darlene, for that excellent presentation. And I think your presentation has covered very important points that are covered in the paper. But these are all very obvious reasons that we all are aware of. And the crux of the matter is that we have a situation where it's a market-driven labor market. It's an employer's market. There's a surplus labor. And the migrants as willing victims, I think, comes up at all points. Dublin has touched upon the squid recruitment sector. And I think at the crux of the matter is also the multi-layered recruitment sector in most of these countries. The whole issue about legalizing or licensing the sub-agents is still an area which there is no agreement on. Sri Lanka, I wish we had someone from Sri Lanka here to hear more about that, because the others don't feel there is merit to that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you cannot really control the recruitment sector. If you want to license them, if there are 700 or 800 licensed recruitment agencies, it will be at least 10 times the size of unlicensed recruitment agencies. Sometimes they come by the name of travel agencies. They don't even call themselves recruitment agencies. We'll go into all that. And now, first of all, in the discussions that will follow, but now I'd like to call upon Professor Supan to make a presentation. It will be particularly interesting to hear, because, you know, Thailand is an important country of origin, sending a lot of workers out. But Thailand is also emerging as a very important destination country. So, Madam, we'd like to hear from you on how Thailand is managing that. Thank you.
Good morning, Rabab, Devlin, Jakim, Ms. Ambassador, and all old friends and new friends. I would like to thank IOM for inviting me to this policy breakfast briefing, which is quite new to me, and quite good idea to have this early in the morning while people are still fresh and not yet occupied by other obligations. For Doreen, I would like to thank for this insightful paper. And this must be based on your first-hand experience. And I found that many findings you indicate here in this paper is very similar to what happened in Thailand. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, we conducted a study of the recruitment industry in Thailand based with the support from USAID. Mm-hmm. And we found more or less the same thing with you. But what you offer us today is to extend, because here, as sending country, we focus here, but you look into the destination, and then because the destination is quite far, we are here in Southeast Asia, but you link to a new to the east, from far east to the near east, mm-hmm. to the Gulf country, and this seems to be a new labor corridor for Southeast Asia, because in the past we talk about Asia Pacific, mm-hmm. now Middle East, the biggest labor market. So this is the first thing that I think that you show us a new perspective of how to look at the flow of labor in this particular corridor. And I think that although you didn't mention in your paper, but it is obvious that we can see that the exploitation that you found based on the very expensive recruitment service plus the rights abuse from the employer side can lead to what we call labor exploitation, mm-hmm. and even human trafficking, which is another important topic among labor migration now. So that's another point is the debt bondage, mm-hmm. because when workers have to pay a big amount that they can never pay back, and they will become debt bondage to the company or to the employers or the counterpart of the recruiters in destination country. So those are very important, and we need to address the issue very, very carefully. The silent points that you made in the three characteristics of recruitment and the role of the private recruitment agency, I agree with all, especially for the Middle East. We had the chance to collect some data in UAE and in Qatar. And early this year, I had the chance to go to Qatar for a meeting and happened to sit next to a Qatari family with a Filipina nanny. The family comprised of the grandmother, the couple, a boy, and then the nanny. So I took the opportunity to interview the nanny. and according to what you say, but she was quite well prepared. Mm-hmm. She learned Qatari language, mm-hmm. and she didn't pay too high. Mm-hmm. But her dream is to go further to Geneva. After having some good saving in Qatar, she would go to Geneva because the wage is higher there. But from that case, we can learn that really this is a big labor market, and it's the employer's market, mm-hmm. as Rabak said. And culturally, it is very interesting to learn about, because although Gulf countries, they are mainly Muslim. Mm-hmm. And in the Muslim male-dominant societies, there are many aspects that have to do with migrant workers, especially female migrant workers. I observed how the father of the boy and the nanny interacted. It was very subtle, and I can understand immediately why many many Indonesian domestic helpers in Saudi Arabia or in other countries suffer a lot, mm-hmm. because this is really when the home is the workplace, mm-hmm. that's a big challenge, right? Then I think that when we talk about this characteristic, if we go into more details about the nature of sector that the recruitment is functioning, we can see some kind of stream. Mm-hmm. For example, for Filipino people, because of their capital, human capital, language, skill, they would enter more into the service sector. Mm-hmm. Some may be in non-service sector, but But you can see that in the hotels, in every place, restaurants, even in the hospital, you can find some health worker from the Philippines, a chef or a manager. While workers from Bangladesh or Sri Lanka or Thailand, they would end up in the construction. Mm-hmm. And so many construction sites in the Gulf countries, because all countries are booming. They need a lot of, if you can imagine, like Gata transform from a fishing mm-hmm. village into a big city mm-hmm. with all the skyscrapers. And with that, they badly need construction workers. And those who are not good in language can only do this. And you can see that a lot of Indonesian women would go to the Gulf, not only for work, but also for religious factor. We interviewed some Indonesian people, and they said that they come here because they would like to visit the Kaaba in Makkah. They would like to come to Makkah. But their salary is very low and working condition is very bad. The next point I would like to make here is about the gap between the private recruiting agency and the employer. Most workers who go to the Gulf countries will have to sign a second employment contract, right? Mm-hmm. Because the national laws in each country have different nature, and the contract that you sign in your country of origin will not be accepted. And with that, recruitment agencies sometimes cannot extend to control the details of the second contract. And if we expect that the recruiters should take responsibility once workers are in destination, that's a big question. Mm. That's a big question, and this is, I think, why this is where the gap is. How can a recruitment agency register in country A, tell employers in country B that you should do this or that? At the beginning, they may agree because they want, but once workers are there, totally depending on the willingness of the country B, right? And I would like to share with you that I saw this as a challenge to the protection mandate of the country of origin, that the country of origin can have its sovereignty over its country, but not on the sovereignty of another country. They have a separate law. I discussed with Thai doctors who went to Taiwan to follow up cases of Thai workers who died of what we call nocturnal sudden death syndrome. They just go to bed and die. And the doctor said that we cannot practice here. We cannot even bring our medicine here because it is against the Taiwanese law. We have to go through the Red Cross, and it must be the permission from the Taiwanese side. And I interviewed the Buddhist monk who performed the funeral for workers who passed away, and he said, "We are here on student visa because the government will not allow us to stay here as a religious group and offer religious services to foreigners, to migrants." So you can see that many kinds of services or protections will depend totally on the law of the country of destination. And with that, among the policy options that Dublin kindly think about that very thoroughly and propose to us, I agree with some, but not all. I agree that bringing sub-agents and brokers into formal sector or regulate them is good, because there are so many brokers in all countries, and those brokers are operating according to their own will. actually the high charge came from this mm-hmm. kind of service, and they are not controlled. So bring them and try to regulate them is good, but this will depend on the amendment of the law.
Mm-hmm.
In the Thai law, recruitment law, when we study that, one of the recommendations was like this: that bring them up from mm-hmm. the underground and register them. And our friend from the Ministry of Labor may be able to share with us that they did at the Department of Employment. They tried to register. I went to Chiang Rai and they said that now we register as you suggested us. But then what should we do with them? Because according to the law, they have no role.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do something not according to the law, they are not to be rich. It will go to the general law that people are cheating other people and not to do with recruitment at all. And they have no link to the formal recruitment agency, so those companies will have no responsibility if they do anything bad. We have to think further that once we bring them from underground, then what should we regulate mm-hmm. and manage in order that they can become a force to facilitate workers. But when you talk about the reduction of the agency number agencies to prevent cutthroat competition, I'm not sure whether the competitiveness among these companies are based on their numbers or based on their offers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is more on their offers. Mm-hmm. Those companies who offer that we would offer you to go immediately and with a high pay, they will attract more workers. And many companies, many agencies would do like that. If you go to Udon Thani, we have some friends there. They would have big billboards saying that, go fast, flying tomorrow. Something like that. And people will just go to them. So it may be the offer rather than the number. That count. Third one, regulating transaction. This is also very good, and transaction is a loophole of malpractice, because when workers or job seekers pay to the recruitment agencies and have no evidence that they have paid such a big amount of money, they cannot claim that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to show to the court, to the lawyer, to anybody. Mm-hmm. So we try to encourage them that when you do that, please do that with some witness, even a person witness, and do mm-hmm. that through the bank, not in cash. But it's the contrary. Most people, they do not do this through the bank because it's a loan money.
Mm-hmm.
They have to borrow that from a loan shark, they don't want to go through the bank to have the record. So they carry cash. And why do they do that without a witness of other people? Because they want to be the first to fly, the first to be recruited. So they keep this as a secret. Some Buddhist monk at the abbot at the temple would say, why don't you come and pay that in front of us so that we can witness that? But this is secret. So they would do that very privately, and that's how the transaction is not regulated. But some private agencies, who are very smart, they say that okay, we accept your bank transfer, but do that in installments. So for example, if a person is to pay 10,000 dollars. Okay, $10,000 to go to Jordan or to split that into four installments, and you do the first one through the bank, and after that the company will say we have some problem with our account, so this time we need cash. So you have only one evidence of one installment paid while you paid the full amount. But when you have the problems and you show you have only one-fourth. And that's the amount that you can be compensated from the company. The last thing that I would like to share with you is about thinking beyond this. You didn't mention about the attempt to make a kind of government-to-government recruitment, which should partly help, right? Like the case of Korea, they would accept only those who come through the government regulation, and no private company can do that. And I have some friends who are from Udon Thani and who are working closely with the job seekers there. And we discussed before we come at the breakfast that we should think about have this kind of grassroots self-recruitment group that workers, some of them are very experienced in going abroad. They have been abroad for 7 times. Some went to Pickbury 7 times already, successively, 7 years. So why don't they gather together and then register under some name according to the law? It can be a community cooperative, or it can be a company limited, or it can be a social enterprise. And I'd like to hear more from our friend. And this kind of company, non-profit, just to help those people to get information and to link to the employers abroad. Now this employment practice is going on, and many workers know their employers, or the employers want them to recruit their younger relatives or siblings to join. So why don't they just do this on their own? And if the law will allow them to do that, those recruiters within the family will not become a broker. Actually, they just do this with no law to endorse them. But they do this because it is a kind of a family or relatives business, and many people could go safely without being cheated. So the alternatives that I can think about and would like to welcome discussion is to have this kind of bottom up alternative that people can help themselves if they want to go abroad. And one more thing that I think that we can help those people is the requirement for an insurance for a worker before their departure. I just learned from Dr. Mala Aziz yesterday. Mm-hmm. We invited her to give a talk about protecting outbound migrant worker. And she mentioned that all Filipino will have to have an insurance from the company, from the recruitment company. And that insurance will cover if they want to go back home, if they die abroad or anything. And this is a real insurance with a insurance company, and workers will pay for that. Actually, the recruitment agency should pay, but they charge it over to the workers. I don't mind whether it is from the worker or from the company, but there should be a real insurance, and this should not be just a kind of some charity work that when workers have problems, somebody would take care of that informally. So I think that I stopped for too long. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Sapong. I wish we could have asked you to carry on. Some excellent ideas have come forward, actually, and your analysis of the situation is extremely incisive. It's true. I mean, on the one hand, we have this very centralized recruitment sector in most of these countries, then with this multi-layered informal sort of agencies. And one of the policy issues that we have been advocating with most of these countries is to decentralize the process, even at the government level. The governance structure, the state governance structure in most of these countries is extremely centralized, and that has added to these layers of recruitment and the layers adding to the cost, adding to the abuse. And I'm glad that, you know, that I hope we'll have more discussions on that. And I'm very happy that you also raised this whole issue about the rights and the protection mandate of the sending countries limited within their borders, and that is why it is so important to have G2G. But unfortunately, if you look at the recruitment industry, the international labor migration, it's is principally in the private sector driven, and G2G driven recruitment is very small. It's very small, and that's, I think, again, the whole gap, and some sort of at the policy level, some sort of agreement, consensus, regime even is possibly important. We are sort of going through in an informal manner towards that, but we hope that through the Colombo process of the Abu Dhabi dialogue, but we are not yet there. And I'm also very glad that you raised the issue of labor trafficking, or trafficking for the purposes of labor exploitation, which is also increasing a lot. I mean, you know, there is possibly more trafficking today taking place for labor exploitation, again, because there is this huge surplus of labor. Migrants are willing to be victims. They want to go out at any cost, and that is why they are being exploited. And I'm also very happy, and I'm sure my colleague down, Dr. Jamie Calderon, will be very happy. You also raised the issue about the many vulnerabilities, also the health vulnerabilities of the migrant workers. And I'm glad that you raised a lot of these issues, which we'll have discussed at a later session. But now I'd like to actually invite Ms. Jaewon Kim, manager. We have been now keenly looking forward to listening to you. It's a very different perspective, the other side of the story. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jaewon Kim, based in Hong Kong. Actually, my room is a little chilly, and also I'm a bit nervous. My voice is really shaking, but if you can understand any point that I raised, just please jump into my words and things. I just want to bring up today the different perspective on the issues that we've been discussing for many, many years. I'm very surprised that things are happening in Korea or Japan or Vietnam, have experience in Vietnam or South Asia. It's happening also with the South Asia, with the Middle East and things. So brokers are behaving very surprising, similar to all of the world. They're international players, and I just want to just bring up the new sort of like stakeholder in this discussion related to the migration, which before I joined the BSI, I never actually thought about that as well. Just let me explain first about who is the BSR, what is BSR doing. And the BSR stands for Business for Social Responsibility, but we no longer say we are stand for Business for Social Responsibility. It's because our member companies, when they hear that, oh, we work for the Business for Social Responsibility, then when they hear the responsibility, the word of responsibility, they freak out. What's the responsibility we have to do? So we no longer say we are Business for Social Responsibility. We just say BSR. We are NGO by U.S. law, but also we are business association. We have more than 300 multinational companies as members under our name, including major players like Microsoft or HP or Gap, H&M's, or you know, from the pearl sector to the financial sectors. So for example, like Citibank and things are also our members. What we do is we're not representing business sectors. We help the business sector to implement or accomplish their social responsibility. So our mission is to help the business to take their social responsibility. So this is our mission. So we do the three different kind of work. One is consulting. We did a consulting work with the business, say that very huge ones, for example, like IBM, if they want to set up the strategy on the sustainability issues, that we give, you know, a lot of consulting on that issue, to the very small, like a very issue-specific issue as well, how we could be accountable to the local NGO in Thailand in the issue of, for example, labor rights in our factories and things like that. And also we did a lot of research with the international organizations like ILO or the UNEPs with the foundation as well. Actually, the reason we start involved with the migration work is through the generous support made by the MacArthur Foundation for past 4 or 5 years. We did other initiatives actually supported by other foundations, international organizations as well. Another one is we do a lot of convening, which means that we bring up the business sector into the table to discuss with the stakeholder in certain perspectives, certain issues. So for example, maybe it's like place like this, maybe bring the NGOs, business sector. Business sectors, very surprisingly, they have very little knowledge in civil society, and they're very afraid sometimes that to discuss some matter with the civil society. Or sometimes maybe they're a little more comfortable with the government sector, but they're not familiar with discussing things together with the civil society or government or international organization. So we did a small like a stakeholder engagement to the huge ones like the ones we're going to have next year with the UNEP in Hong Kong, or the end of this year we're going to have the annual conference in New York with the more than 1,000 participants from the business sector as well as the civil society and the international organization to discuss the new idea on the business and social responsibilities. So as I told you before, for the migration related work that we have been supported by the MacArthur Foundation for the past 3-4 years to carry out some migration related to research, or as well as developing the toolkits for business and some training work for the business sector as well. So this the paper we produced in the year 2008, the first sort of like a paper, what's the responsible role for the business in migration sector, was the almost the first paper ever produced, you know, on the area of what business can do for the migration related issues. I'd like to really, this is actually one of later on I'll more comment on the Dublin's paper, but I just want to introduce to the business, the role of the business in the migration and what is happening in the business sector and how they're doing at this moment. Mm-hmm. So actually up until now the employers, especially the business sector, wasn't actually considered as the major stakeholders in the migration. It's not only the civil society or government, international organizations thought it that way. The businesses themselves have thought it that way. But for past like 4-5 years, there's a growing the expectation to the business not only pursuing the interest, the profit, but also they have to take a responsibility on social issue. The more and more the multinational companies are trying to take the different, you know, the perspectives on the issue that normally they never thought about that before. For example, like issues like Apple, for example, the Foxconn issues in China, that the Foxconn itself is not Apple's, the factory, direct management factories, but now the people in the States, people think the Foxconns are, you know, almost like Apple's factory, you know. Then there are a lot of internal migrants, but Apple should take a responsibility over what the Foxconn is doing in China. That's like a new movement actually happening now, and the businesses are aware of that now. So, and also the other thing is that the recent initiatives like the UN's guiding principle on the human rights and business actually influence heavily a lot these days. Mm-hmm. This is not like, you know, the law, you know, that no one can actually take the company into the court, say that this company hasn't done any, you know, work on the human rights and things, but business sectors are taking this initiative very seriously. They start reviewing their internal policies and then assessing that what sort of human rights impact they are actually happening in their business, the production lines, for example, or the business organization itself and things. So actually, this UN guiding principle, so-called WAGI frame, actually brings a very good tools for the civil societies as well as international organization and the government as well, because they refer this rugged frames or lot this thing. This rugged frame actually asks the business sector to respect the human rights, and if there is any violation happening in their business, then they should provide a remedy, and also they should have a proper reason system inside, and then have to monitor their the violence every the continuously. Through this the different sort of like a growing expectation to the business sector, some of the multinational companies doing they involved the migration related project at this moment. As a BSR, we recommend the 3 steps to the actually the business sectors. The first, we ask a company to educate themselves, because normally they're not aware of what is happening in their factory. So we ask them finding out how your workers are recruited, including workers in their supply chain, not direct factory, but including first-tier supply chain, seconds, and things like that. So we ask them to educate yourself first, find out what's happening. Second of all, we ask the company to engage with the suppliers and workers. I would have to say that the direct factory, directly managed factories, their conditions are a bit better. For example, like the factories in Malaysia directly supported, managed by HP, for example, IBM, Sardines, so they're actually the migrant situation is a lot better. But we ask the company to engage with their suppliers, for example, second tier suppliers or third tier suppliers and stuff. So we actually recommend business sector to hire the migrant worker directly, not through the agencies. Mm-hmm. If you're going to hire, many cases, the Middle East is more complicated, but for example, like in Malaysia or other parts of the country, that the supplier themselves is sometimes they're not employer. The recruitment agency play as role of the employer. So as a law, they're employer. So the later on, migrant actually can't ask their actual employer to take care of the issues related to themselves. So what we ask the companies are not make the your recruitment agency as a legal employer. You should directly hire, you should be direct employer of the migrant, so that later on you could be fully comfortable to the migrant related issue. And also we ask the companies to support their suppliers in building direct relationship with the employment agencies origin countries. Actually, this is really happening these days. Means the supply encourage the supplier to include the migrant directly. For example, one of the major apparel company, they have a factories all over the world. Their suppliers go to for example Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and places like that, and go directly hire the people so that migrant did no need to pay the recruitment related fee at all. So recently we also set up the program for one of the major suppliers to the HP based in Malaysia, that they should help them to set up the process to hire the migrant directly from Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and other places as well. Of course, it's a huge financial burden for the company. But when you think in the long term, from the business perspective, you pay maybe, for example, like $300 more, $400 more in advance, but your worker will stay longer in your factory. Later on, explain a little bit more the difference between different industry or sectors, because it is quite different from pearl company construction to the construction workers, for example, or electronic workers, electronic sector. Because a pearl and the electronic sector, they have put in so much of the investment in their country, so they cannot just pull their business out of that country quickly. So they need to invest a certain amount of money in the human resource. It's been a little easier. But like, for example, construction, their construction finished within 6 months. So it's a little harder for the construction sector to hire the migrant directly. But it has been quite successful for the apparel company as well as electronics company to directly hire the migrant from the neighboring country or that they be further out. Of course, that the suppliers has to constantly monitoring the how the recruitment happening in the sending country. They often made a trip to the sending country. Of course, they cannot just go to the countryside and hire the people. But there is, of course, agency, sort of like agency type companies there in the sending country, but they are directly, you know, involved together in terms of the selecting of workers or in terms of the giving them a pre-departure program, in terms of the checking their health care, in terms of the providing work permit sending. So we are encouraging the business sector to work it that way. Also, this is the second sort of like our recommendation. First, they educate themselves, and the second is engage with the suppliers, and then also encourage their supplier to directly hire the migrant. And also, you will see that these no fee initiatives, you know, a lot these days made from the NGOs as well. Mm-hmm. For example, like the NGO called Human Rights and Business, I don't know, probably the lady from Bangladesh have heard about that. There is a Dhaka principle, number one policy, the recommendation that made by this NGO say no recruitment fee to the migrants. It has to be paid by employer. So there is a movement happening right now to reduce the cost that to the migrant workers. Okay, so as I told you before that there is a difference between industries. So for example, like a apparel company, electronics company special, they're doing actually quite good. There is their own initiative called EICC, which the electronic companies get together and then discuss about how they can achieve the sustainability in the workplace and monitoring workers, the working hours, and then they're monitoring the situation of the factories and including the migrant workers as well. A prior company, of course, the leading company like Nike, Adidas, and things are they're actually checking quite well. But I have to say that we have been doing the research in the Jordans or the Qatars and places like that. The sectors there are not actually aware of what they should do. They have to admit with that. So, for example, we talk about good practice in recruitment, employment of migrant workers, and in Jordan, that they say their responses always say that it's not our problem. It's sending countries a problem. They themselves paid a lot of money there. What should we do? So, and then also it's because they are the mainly. The migrants are working in the domestic area, and then as well as majorities are working in the construction sectors, which is very hard to monitor the workers' movement and things because projects are really short, and also the construction companies are small and medium enterprise, a lot of them, so it's getting really difficult. But I would say that there is a lot of the things that we could do actually. For example, like Qatar's, the case of the Qatar, then 2024, I guess, there's a World Cup happening, then there's a huge demand of construction workers, which means a lot of international attention will go on that country, how this the stadium is going to be built, how this, you know, the dormitory has been built and things. There is the chance for civil society or international organizations or the government can say something through this event as well. Just what happened in London Olympic, that there is a lot of attention on the migrant who built the stadiums and dormitories and things like that. So we are slowly, what we were doing in Jordan's or the Qatar's and things, actually the apparel sectors are through the ILO's Better Work Initiatives, where the under the Better Work Initiative apparel companies are constantly monitored by ILOs and all the companies and things. So we are not actually working with the apparel sectors, but we are engaging with the construction sector to make them understand and educate them to what they should do, what is expected from the international standard and things. And the second one is the same point that Dr. De Spahn made, that bring up the sub-agent and the brokers into the formal sectors, as just, Ms. Fatima said, it's very controversial issues that, first of all, that who is the broker, definition by broker is very difficult. For example, I introduce a word to you, then am I a broker? And we are relatives. How the government can control, how you could actually regulate them as well. And then the country like Jordan, that there is not major the recruitment agencies exist, like almost 70-80% of workers are recruited through the private connection, that is actually quite hard. But the reason we want to bring up the sub-agent and brokers to the public area is we want to clarify what sort of conditions and the contract and things the migrants have with these brokers and things. I guess in order to accomplish that purpose, that we have to make sure that especially the receiving country, then we need a mechanism to check before they are actually to settle into their workplace, to see what sort of the contract they have, what sort of information they have before, to make sure that they know the very, very initial, very the basic information they have before. So related to this issue, what we are trying to do, we have been doing, not in the Middle East, but in other sector in Malaysia, that for one of the major factories working for the electronic companies, so we did, once they arrive in the Malaysia, we do the pre-departure training program for the migrant, just like the IOMs did for the, for example, refugees and other migrant goes to the state in Canada. So this company support this program after they directly recruit the migrant from, for example, Sri Lanka or Nepal. As soon as they arrive in Malaysia, they give them training for basic training that what sort of work they should do, what the legal right they have in Malaysia, and how what the salary should be, and what sort of dormitory they could have, and things like that. So this is not mandatory the government of the Malaysian imposed to, or this is not the their brand or the buyers is asking them to do, but it's purely business perspectives from made by the factory. They're thinking that this is good for our business. We could have a skilled, stable workforce for next 1 to 3 years. This is bring up the benefit to us. So I'd like to just bring your attention to the role of the business sector in the migration issue. Thank you for inviting me today, and I hope that I have given you a little bit of insight of what is happening in business sector. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kim. This was actually very encouraging to learn that actually there are some good practices and experience already existing. Mm-hmm. And what comes to mind is that these are possibly limited to the big multinationals. How much do you cover actually the smaller national companies within the country who still remain the main employers?
Yeah.
So that is also very important. Because, I'll just give you very quickly an example. When we had recently the crisis in Libya, mm-hmm. and the migrant workers were all fleeing, and it was just this very tiny handful of small multinational companies, foreign companies, who are actually looking out for their migrant workers in arranging for the travel or paying back their unpaid salary, etc., etc. But the bulk of the workers were employed by the national companies, and which completely left out. So they are you're not yet working with national companies.
We have actually the suppliers, they're national companies, okay. But they work for the multinational.
So there is some sort of a responsibility connection. Or accountability through that
exactly.
supply chain.
Exactly.
Yes. No. This is very, yeah. very, very encouraging to hear that, and also you know it's important to see how much of that is covered within the Middle East in the Middle East market. That's mm-hmm. where the bulk of the very vulnerable workers go there. Mm-hmm. When we are talking about Filipino workers or the Thai workers, to some extent, these are possibly at a level where they are a little bit better oriented, possibly a little bit at a higher skill level. But then we have the bulk of the workers. Like I look after South Asia, bulk of the workers from South Asia who are at a lower rung of the labor market. They are less educated, less skilled, and they are definitely much more susceptible to vulnerability. Well, we have heard three excellent presentations, each in their own right. I won't say that they were even commentaries. I mean, each in their own right are excellent three presentations. Many of these issues have come forward, and I know all of you have questions in your mind. I will not go into any analysis or even try to sum up what they have said, but we'll open up the floor for all of you to offer to comment, not necessarily limiting yourself to what they have said, but also if you have any additional perspective from your work, that will be also, I think, add value to the discussions that we have today. So the floor is open. When you take the floor, please give a brief introduction of yourself so we all know who is making the question. Thank you. Yes, Yuko.
Thank you very much. I'm a senior labor migration development specialist for the IOM regional office for Asia Pacific. I would like to thank all of the presenters and the moderator, Madam Chair, for this excellent meeting that you're having. This is actually my first time to be here. And I would like to give a couple of comments from the programmatic point of view in relation to what IOM is doing. First of all, the ideal case scenario for this recruitment system is government-to-government reducing the cost. But I'm also a firm believer in promoting private sector, and I think that's in this global world, it's not probably the best solution to eliminate those recruitment agencies. And I want to introduce these innovative approaches that some of the countries in the region are actually doing. A month ago, I was in Bangladesh. That government of Bangladesh was organizing a workshop in implementing this monitoring the group, which consists of the government agencies, civil societies, but also including the recruitment agencies. So what they do is to catch those unethical practices that are happening in the countries of origins. Of course, the frustration happens in the countries of destinations because very often, you know, particularly in the case of Middle East, it's very difficult to have an access even for recruitment agencies. So what was good about this meeting was that they are promoting the discussions between the recruitment agencies and government, as well as civil societies. And the tendency was, and I have to tell, be honest, with our IOM's programming, was to really, you know, point out, oh, you recruitment agency, you have to really, you know, practice better. But as a matter of fact, and the Dublin pointed out that they are really smart, and they are really familiar with the procedures, and they are often, they can advise some of the policies that can be improved. So that was very inspiring to me, and I think this is some of the things that I want to keep in mind in my position to really promote that. Second of all, the vulnerability part was, you know, was discussed, and Dr. Jamie has enormous experiences in this. But I think the key to this is to really strengthen, raise awareness of the migrants themselves. If they don't really stand up the vulnerability part will not be addressed. So we are promoting, we are coordinating with the governments, civil societies, and doing a lot of projects in promoting awareness through pre-departure orientations, migrant resource center, research center, all sorts of things. So, I'm sure that many of you are also practitioners, and I would be very, very happy if you can reach out to me. Yes. So, well, that's all for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Yuko. And I would like to add to the whole issue about raising awareness, and we all do our work, is also enhancing the skills of the, of the workers. Because they are, as Dublin has rightly pointed out, they are sometimes willing victims. They are aware of the vulnerabilities. They are told that you'll have to pay only, say, X amount of cost. They will willingly pay three times the cost. When we ask them at the departure, how much are you paying, they will just say, quote the official figure. They are willing victims. They're desperate to go out. What do you do in that situation? I think the only way that you can increase their sort of bargaining power is when you enhance their skills. And that's also one of the focus that we as IOM have been advocating more and more with the governments. All right. Yes. Yes, please.
My name is Nakhon Sinpacha. I'm from Ministry of Labor. I'm sorry I come late. It took me almost 2 hours from I'm not familiar with this area. Okay. Talking about migrant recruitment, yeah, it takes a long time if we discuss here. Yeah. Regarding about middlemen, because it is a business, yeah. So how to middlemen tend to be corrupt and tend to be have a profit. So it is really difficult. I used to be the director general for employment, yeah. Try to do many things. Shortly, I would like to say that EPS, Employment Permit System of Korea, is one of the best that we should look at it. Yeah, because the principle of EPS is they say that middlemen is tend to be profit and tend to collapse. In Thailand, we have a problem about the cheating of worker, job seeker. The second one is overcharge for expense to go abroad. It's like a eternally problem, cannot solve, yeah? Because it's a business, and can make a lot of money too. And talking about the Middle East, it is really I think it for Thailand it's a new market, and it is really difficult for job seeker migrant worker to work there. It's tough regarding the climate, the religious, the culture, yeah. Very, very, yeah. So, so it's, I think it's important to pre-departure educate for the job seeker who want to work there. The nature of the job seeker, they want to go tomorrow, suddenly, immediately, yeah. If because they have want to work there. Mm-hmm. So, I think. EPS, Employment Permit System from Korea, is one of the best. Formerly, Japan initiated the intern technical intern training program, and now, Korea changed to EPS. It's similar, but EPS is more comprehensive. So, And EPS handled by KLAB, KLAB, Korean, I think that KLAB. It's a non-government organization too. I think it's absolutely, because EPS need the willingness, bona fide of receiving country to handle the worker, the migrant worker too. They Korea send the officer to Thailand to recruit physical and educate them first in Thailand 3 months. If the job seeker pass the training program pre-departure training, they go to class center and have another 1 month train in Korea, in Seoul, and then distribute to SME to work. That I think it comprehensive and it easy to handle, to take care, easy to access to information. In Thailand, you know, there is a internet overseas employment private employment agency, almost 250 agencies. How can the job seeker evaluate what is good, what is bad, who is good, who is bad? It is difficult. And so Charlie, I have to recommend EPS and then collab. Yeah, because broker is a business, and you know the nature of, if I'm the receiving country, I want tomorrow, hey, can I have worker a week, next week? And the worker also want to go, so they also want immediately at the work of it, so everything difficult to handle. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, and thank you very much also for taking the trouble to come down. I think your presence is extremely important for us. And yes, Jerry, one point is that EPS model is often cited, the Korean model is often cited as one of those best models. But then it is also seen as sometimes a bit daunting. It is also, you know, they have very strict conditions. The skill level, it's mostly for skill level. But the bulk of the workers that go out to the Middle East are at the less skilled or lower skilled. And often, I mean, I can say for Bangladesh, for instance, it's extremely daunting to even qualify for the many conditions, etc., that the Korean employment takes. So that's, you know, that's also to be kept in mind. What about the bulk of the less skilled workers?
Can I just add on something to that? Because I think a lot of almost everyone mentioned the government-to-government. EPS is an example. New Zealand is a program with the Pacific Island states. Mexico and the Caribbean is a program with Canada. And I think aside from what Rabab mentioned about the skills, I think one key issue is the how many people are we talking about here? Yeah. Because the Philippines, during when they were starting out in the 1970s, they were thinking, we're going to do this government to government. And then they realized that they can't. And that they really have to have recruitment agents, especially in the case of a country like the Philippines that sent 1.4 million workers last year alone. What government can handle such? And I think that when it comes to meeting the demand and meeting the supply, making it work worthwhile, government to government could provide the best practices, I think, that hopefully the private sector will adopt. But they're limited, but important role.
Yeah, I'll just give you an example for Bangladesh, for instance. Of the total recruitment that takes place, overseas migration or labor migration that takes place, the government employment agency only accounts for 1% of the recruitment that takes place. I mean, even despite all the efforts that are made for G2G ventures, yes.
Perhaps we can make mixture between G2G and only a few qualified private employment qualified, authorized.
Yes,
that's yeah. So are they coming up with
and another thing is we have to think about the what kind of work that we do. Bubbly picking and to be the construction worker is different.
Yes,
so it needs special recruitment or special, yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, Jerry. Yes.
First of all, I want to commend Dublin for, I think, an excellent briefing and presentation on it. I think it is. I'm Jerry Huguet, by the way. I'm an independent and unemployed consultant. I think it's an under-researched area, and I think it's a very useful contribution. Since the EPS has come up as a good example, I would like to ask Dublin if what's the feasibility of any of the receiving governments in the Middle East of adopting some aspects of the EPS system? Okay. And I think that takes us a little bit to the direction of what is the role of government responsibility, because in irony of the EPS, of course, is that it was put in place by the receiving country. So more has been done to protect migrant workers from Vietnam and Indonesia and Thailand and so on by the receiving country than has been done by their own government in many cases. And I think Khun Bakon is already hinting at perhaps more of a mixture of public and private. One thing I think governments could probably do more of is a public option or public agencies to try to do some of the things that the private sector has been doing poorly. Yes, maybe a government agency can't deploy 1.4 million workers by itself, but it seems that there could be a government agency which is doing its best to try to deploy workers within the legal framework, but within the legal cost, and do it efficiently to show how it can be done. It was also mentioned the role of the informal or the suppliers to the private recruitment agencies, okay, the lowest level of the middlemen. It seems that the every provincial labor office in Thailand has has an office. Could they perform some of that role by disseminating more information at the local levels, at the provincial and even the district level, on what are the procedures for seeking work overseas, recommend some of the best recruitment agencies, and particularly tell them how to go through the government recruitment process. So not to displace the private sector, but to put out good examples that would, in fact, compete with the private sector and hopefully encourage the private sector to improve. I think the now it's not to say that government deployment always works well. Also, there have been cases in Vietnam where even the local governments do a lot of recruitment and placement because it's very profitable. Okay, and so there can be abuses even in government systems that has to be controlled. I think it would be a good idea for one of the succeeding policy briefs, if Dublin's going to have the opportunity, to really look at government roles in this. This brief seems to make the assumption that governments are trying their best, but they don't know exactly which policies work. I think we probably need a little deeper investigation of what government, not only policy, but actually implementation of policies and the government versus private sector relationship. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes. Down the table. Yes, please. And then Sadia will come to you.
Sudhasini Gavirai, Thai Labour Campaign. She's Sudhasini Gavirai, Director of Thai Labour Campaign. Actually, Thai Labour Campaign, we are campaigning the freedom of labor association, and we are working with the grassroots people in Udon Thani, because this is the province that people go out to work abroad. So now we are organizing a group of grassroots people, especially the families, very big families around of the workers.
เพราะช่วงที่ผ่านมาเรามองว่าทั้งกระทรวงแรงงานและทั้งกรมการจัดหางานคือไม่ได้ดูแลคนงานอย่างจริงจัง
because we analyze we know that the government reduce their role in taking care of workers
พร้อมกับกฎหมายคุ้มครองคนหางานซึ่งเป็นกฎหมายที่เก่ามากและก็ไม่สอดคล้องกับสถานการณ์ปัจจุบัน
Especially the labor protection law, it is quite out of date and cannot cope with the new challenges.
แล้วก็เพราะเป็นจุดอ่อนแล้วก็เป็นจุดอ่อนทำให้คนงานนั้นเข้าไม่ถึงสิทธิ์ก็คือการอบรมของกระทรวงแรงงานโดยกรมจัดหางานก็คืออบรมก่อนเดินทางแค่วันเดียวดังนั้นทำให้คนงานไม่รู้สิทธิ์
For example, you know that the workers cannot access to the education because we have only one day training of the government, especially from the Department of Employment. So only one day training is not enough for educate people.
โครงการรณรงค์เพื่อแรงงานไทยก็เลยมีเป้าหมายมีวัตถุประสงค์ที่จะไปตั้งสหภาพที่อุดรธานี
So.We like our objective to work there in Udon Thani because we would like them to empower them to educate themselves as an organized group.
เราเน้นเรื่องหนึ่งคนงานต้องรู้จักป้องกันตนเองก่อนเดินทาง
So we advise them to organize their own by you have to know about before working abroad.
แล้วก็คนงานก็ต้องเช็คให้ได้ว่าบริษัทปลายทางนี้รับพอมีโควต้าจริงหรือไม่ในการรับคนงานไปทำงาน
The workers should can check the positions the job positions abroad by themselves
ตอนนี้สถานการณ์ที่อุดรธานีเริ่มดีขึ้น
So now we estimate right now the situation at that area is better because we can like a campaign and protect themselves to not to be cheated.
แล้วก็ตอนนี้เราทำงานร่วมกับเลขาของรัฐมนตรีว่าการกระทรวงแรงงาน
Yeah, we trying to like lobby and talk with discuss with secretary of the Ministry of Labor, Minister of Labor.
ก็ทำงานร่วมกับการมาที่การแรงงานรัฐสภา
and now we are connecting with the labor commissions of the parliament
ตอนนี้ก็คือมันเหมือนสถานการณ์เริ่มดีขึ้น
so we are thinking that the connection is quite better
เพราะว่าการเมืองก็เริ่มให้ความสนใจและก็เป็นของคนงานขึ้นบ้าง
So because we raise issues to the politicians, because they should like have these policies.
Thank you.
All
right. Thank you very much. No, it's very important for organization such as yours to be doing that work at the grassroots level, as I believe Dr. Supang had also mentioned earlier. That it's important that you know even.Returning migrants themselves that have experience of being abroad, being able to educate those in their community about the risks, about the process to reduce their vulnerability and to make them better equipped to go abroad. Thank you. That's very important work that you're doing. Sadia?
Thank you, madam, for giving me the floor. First of all, I'd like to extend my thanks to IOM Bangkok office and also to NPR for organizing this breakfast briefing.Like the last three meetings, I find this one also very useful, and this document is a very good work. I must congratulate the opening. And what I wanted to share with all of us actually has already been shared by my previous speakers, but I just want to highlight the commitment of the government of Bangladesh, which has also been shared by one of the speakers, that we are trying hard, government is trying hard and trying to bring in all the stakeholders in streamlining the private recruitment process, the recruitment agencies. But we fully agree that the G2G arrangement is the best arrangement, and is because the government is committed to protect the rights of the migrants. In this regard, I just want to know a little bit more from Daphne regarding, you have mentioned, you have referred one MOU between Qatar and Nepal, and you have mentioned that Qatar is providing all the travel and all other expenses. So if you can just throw a little bit more light, what are the other expenses that are covered in this MOU? And we all understand this is a shared responsibility of both the country of origin and country of destination to have their specific roles in streamlining these scrupulous recruiting agencies and the brokers. The states are committed to it. We are engaged in the Colombo process and also in Abu Dhabi dialogue. And also the international organizations, the UN organizations and IOM are doing a lot to improve the situation. But I was just wondering whether you can also give us some lights on how or what, in addition to what's going on, how the IOM can help, particularly in the Middle East region, where the bulk of the irregular migration is taking place. How IOM can help in this regard? I think that will enrich our discussions.
Sadia, Dublin, would you like to respond?
I think, can I just
yes,
submit
please.
Before this?
Yes.
I just want to give Dublin to prepare answer of it. Since I came from the Korea where the EPS is implemented, and then also I'm the one who actually 5 years ago helped the government to properly implement the program there. So I'll just take an opportunity to explain a little bit on this program and what has been happening since the government implemented EPS. First of all, this G2G arrangement has been very successful in terms of eliminating the brokers in Korea. So before it was the brokers, the both sides, for example, receiving country like Korea and then sending country, both of them are take a profit out of this process. Now in Korea, virtually no one doing this kind of business, meaning that importing a worker from abroad and taking a profit out of this process. But as just the gentleman rightly pointed out, in terms of the brokers, the behavior in sending country, it hasn't been successful. It's because, as Dima rightly pointed out, the channel is so narrow, more competition there, and also sometimes receiving countries, the governments involved with the brokers' activity, meaning that they're themselves taking profit out of this process. Because the channel is so narrow, you migrant workers try to pull any string as they could have, and then through this process, there is more recruitment, related to the profit is happening. So in terms, so for the Korean side, it has been successful. Let alone what is really happening for the workers, but at least they have been protected in terms of the having a same wage as the Korean workers, for example, or in terms of the right to access to the service like counselings and things, and has been very successful. But for the receiving country side, through this program, I'm not quite sure how much has been made improvement for the migrants' life. Mm-hmm. The second one is that the government side in receiving side in Middle East, it's actually quite tricky. For example, let's just say the Bangladesh government try to implement a lot of the policy on to protect the migrant workers. The agency in the, for example, Qatar, they say they see the Nepal and Bangladesh countries and see, oh, which country is more easier to import migrant workers. They wouldn't go to the Bangladesh because it's so complicated to bring the worker to the Qatar. So this is a competition between countries as well. And then those recruiters, they're not bound to the one country. They're looking at the, as Yuko rightly say, they're very smart. They've been checking which country is easier to bring the workers and which country is easier to make the profit out of this process. So it's actually a little bit hard for the sending country to implement the proper policy to protect their workers. It's actually more easier for receiving countryside to protect their workers. So as for the Middle East, I have to say that the government's initiatives not as good as we want them to be. So for example, a case of the Qatar, there is so unreasonable regulations and things there. It's very hard. But the good news is, for example, like the free industrial zone in the Jordan, for example, that there is a lot of apparel industry there, and then a lot of pressure coming from U.S. that you have to protect the workers there. And then the government in Jordan, before that, they were not really interested in what the workers, migrant workers are doing there. But now, that because of the pressures and free trade agreement with the U.S. and the involvement with from the ILO through the Better Work and things, actually the government of the Jordan tried to have an MOU with the Egypt neighboring country where they're sending a lot of migrant workers with other countries as well. So it's actually hard to make the receiving country to take a responsibility on the migrant workers they're having, but there is a way to push them to take steps.
Thank you very much, Governor.
I mean, clearly the pressure from the outside for the Middle East and for some Middle East countries, for instance, Jordan, the UAE, almost, I mean, I think you could say that for countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council, you know, members, there is a pressure. And for instance, the UAE has come up with new regulations, I think about a year and a half ago, which is quite progressive in a way. It's actually requiring all recruitment agencies in the UAE to accept joint liability, meaning I don't care what happens to the worker. You're just a recruiter, yes, but you will be jointly liable if that worker didn't get the wage, if that worker didn't get the contract that he signed up for. And it's actually copying almost in toto what the Philippine government is imposing to its own recruitment agents. So clearly there is a lot of pressure from the outside in terms of coming up with regulations that would hone in on how the recruitment agencies can conduct themselves. The question is enforcement. The question is how much discussion is really going on between the countries of both sending and receiving, and coming up with even regional or shared platforms or shared agreements from the regional at a regional basis. I think would be the next way to go, not just the MOU. Jerry was asking whether the Middle East countries are thinking going towards the EPS system. I'm not sure that's where it's going. I think that there is a lot of interest to keep the private sector in and try to keep them more regulated and come up with regulations that control them. Because of the bulk involved and the fact also that it's a business. There are many businesses in the Middle East that are making money off recruiting workers, and so I don't see any interest of, let's say, the UAE saying we're going to be coming up with an agreement with each country in able to do that. I believe that Israel had some discussions with a number of countries in the region as well. I think with the Philippines, for instance, the Philippines is not interested to have a G2G. So it's an approach that is ideally makes a lot of sense. But I think if you think about the economics of it, supply, demand, businesses, it might not fly as how we wanted it to fly. I'll get back to you with regards to the specific of the MOU, and I believe that this is actually one of the MOUs that you could access online, Nepal and Qatar, and what specific arrangements that there is. And what's interesting is that there has been a number of MOUs between countries of destination and countries of origin in the UAE, in the Middle East, and here. in the region that actually I outlined more specific ones. For instance, placement fees. You're surprised. Usually MOUs are very general. So there seems to be this trend towards making specific pronouncements in the MOU about what can and cannot be done in recruitment, which I think is a good step. Jordan had just put out an MOU with the Philippines, with Indonesia, and it's specific, explicit features there. The question, of course, is enforcement. So, but it's getting there, and I think that the more we talk about it, the more that there will be a discussion on this. Just one point on awareness, because I hear that a lot. I hear that a lot when you say, all we need to do is inform the migrants. All we need to do is tell them what's happening. But I'm telling you, I've spoken to many of them. I've sat with them in meetings. I've sat with them in their kitchen. I've sat with them while they are in the embassy taking shelter because they were, you know, exploited by their employers. Many of them know, and many of them know more than me. Many of them know more than the government officials that are supposed to help them. They know what's the deal. So I know that we want to educate them and wanted to make sure that they're aware, but I think the question here is, are we actually giving them the opportunity to exercise what they know? It is the agency. It is the lack of agency. I know that I'm supposed to get paid $400 a month as a domestic worker from the Philippines, but I will not exercise that knowledge because I don't have agency. And that is the problem. The problem is not the knowledge, especially for countries like Indonesia, the Philippines. For the most part, I think Sri Lanka is getting there. Knowledge is not the issue. I mean, I think for Bangladesh, it could be for new ones, new emerging countries here in the region, it is. But for countries that have been sending workers for many years, these workers know. They know everything. They know the rules and regulations, and they know, and they just need to be empowered so that they could make the right decisions.
But would you like to say there is a mechanism in receiving country to take that complaint from the migrant?
That is where the enforcement, I'm saying, is the key. That's why when the UAE, this is really interesting, the UAE came up with an arrangement that would actually allow the government to track whether the wage is paid or not. And then this tracking system would then flag an employer if the money was not remitted. And so if the government's role could actually be coming up with regulations, mechanisms that make sure that the contracts are followed, I think that is where we wanted to go. These technological innovations that would actually allow enforcement of what's in the contract. Because once you come up with that, then it's easier to enforce all these rules.
Thank you, Dublin. I mean, you know, you've done my job for me. I will not even attempt to sort of summarize what has been said, but I think very important points came up. And as Dublin was saying, I mean, if I start off with the last point, that the migrants know, and it's not only about the more matured markets like Philippines, the source markets, but even the emerging markets. The migrants know, but they are the willing victims. There is a surplus labor. There's a huge push factors from these countries to go abroad for work. And there is this notion, so they are willing sort of victims. Even if you tell them on and on that, you know, these are your rights, you have to go and register yourself, you have to go with your proper papers, it's not happening. They're not their heads, they're willing victims. So what do we do? I think Dublin touched in a paper about harmonization of policies and regulations. That is missing. That's where I think the recruitment agencies, the employers, they all skirt around that. That's the loophole, the gap that they abuse. And I think that's where it's very important. I mean, while we cannot actually have micro-level sort of cooperation, collaboration, where the government actually oversees individual contracts for different companies. I think even at the macro level, between countries to countries, if there could be framework of cooperation and collaboration, at least some broad principles to agree, I think that would be one step forward. There are G2G agreements. There are. I mean, some of you have seen some of these agreements, the MOUs that exist. These are not binding. These are some sort of an agreement, gentlemanly agreement, gentlewomanly agreement across the table, mostly gentlemanly actually. And they agree on these MOUs, but these are extremely vague, very broad brushing on principles. These do not go down to the nitty-gritties of the contracts. And it's very important. There are, I mean, we have the Korea model, but it's a very exclusive model that's not possibly replicable where we have millions of workers leaving many of these countries every year. The UAE model, it's starting where they have this contract verification, there is this framework, but we are still yet to see how much of that can be actually universalized within even of the many people that come from different countries. So that is yet to be seen. Mm-hmm. I think even at the macro level, through regional collaboration of, say, the sending countries and the receiving countries, getting together and agreeing on certain principles. That's at the government level. The recruiting agencies coming up with some code of ethics, some code of principles on recruitment, and some sort of mechanism where the governments and the recruiting agencies also can be brought within that framework. That's important. We're very encouraged to see that it's actually business responsibility. I think that's the crux of the matter. And not only about the big companies, smaller companies. I mean, there are now many companies which are outsourced to different countries. Say, for instance, in Bangladesh, there are export processing zones. And many other countries have that, where there are actually these companies produce products which are all to be sent out to some foreign buyers abroad. And whether the even though, so they are almost like migrant workers within their own countries. But are international principles and standards even been followed within there? Most of these export processing zones, for instance, do not even allow trade unionism. So there is a double standard there. But in that sense, then of course the big companies will have to see, as you mentioned some, they have to see whether some of those principles, some of the standards can be applied there, whether there can be some rating, some mechanism. I would try to say it has to be a combination of different. I mean, mm-hmm. there is no one size fits all. As Khun Nakhon was saying that, you know, it has to be a combination of private government. There has to be responsibility of the business, responsibility of the government. That cannot be shed. I mean, there is a responsibility of the sending countries to see that their workers in the first place know what they're getting into, seeing to it that there is some sort of mechanism to make them aware, to make them skilled so they're not abused. But I think there is a responsibility also at the other end, and that is where there is a gap still. There are different frameworks of collaboration. We know about the Colombo process. I'm sure most around this table know about the Colombo process, where the major labor-sending countries of Asia, in Southeast and South Asia, get together to agree on certain principles and areas where they can collaborate to have a better bargaining power. Again, not ganging up, this is not unionism, but at least agreeing on how to move forward certain common interests of the workers. And it is also encouraging that through the Colombo process, there is also now a dialogue, standing dialogue between the GCC countries and some other countries, destination countries in Asia, and the Colombo process. And we'll have to see, they recently at the last meeting in April in Manila, they actually adopted a regional cooperation framework. Again, it's a very broad principle, it's a broad sort of cooperation framework, but at least they're moving towards, at least agreeing that yes, it is possible in their own interest, both sides, to have better standards for regulating the recruitment of migrant workers in their countries. All right. This debate can go on, but I believe our time is up. But thank you very much, and this should not be the end of it all. I mean, the next one is on...
Actually, quite related to this pre-departure orientation, and it's focusing on the experience of Nepal, Indonesia, and the Philippines.
Okay, thank you very much. And we hope we can see you back next month for that. We'll be sending out a notice, and we hope that you can also tell your friends and colleagues that we have this this policy debate every month, and we can see more and more faces and perhaps move into even to a bigger room. Thank you again for making the time and coming to see us. Thank you, Dublin. Thank you, Kim, for making the time. And we might not be seeing Dublin more often in Bangkok. In fact, this is possibly one of our last meetings here. But we will be seeing her as a resource person, as working in the field of migration in the years to come. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.